continue talking a bit on Gakuryo Jinshu. One of the things that Rin Master was accused of by some of her more opinionated disciples back in 76 when her great third Kensho happened was that she'd kind of lost the track with real Buddhism and with the teachings of Soto Zen. Teachings of Lotus Blossom are really teachings on the harmonization of our body and mind with the eternal. The harmonization of body and mind means the harmonization of, you can view it as harmonization of the body, which is the kind of vessel of karmic inheritance, with the Buddha mind, or it could be viewed as harmonization of this body and mind with the eternal. And anyway, that's what Lotus Blossom is about. That's how it's done at a really deep level. So listen what Dogen says. The truth of Buddhist training has been handed on to us by our predecessors. And for this, it is impossible to use a selfish mind. We can gain the truth of Buddhism neither with mind nor without mind. It must be remembered that if the will to train and the way of the Buddhas are not harmonized, neither body nor mind will know peace. If body and mind are not at peace, they know only discomfort. The first sentences of this are talking about getting out of the driver's seat. The truth of Buddhist training has been handed down to us by the ancestors, and for this it is impossible to use the selfish mind. In other words, we've got to get out of the driver's seat. We've got to make use of the Buddha nature, which is sitting there available to us if we'll only open our hearts to it and ask for its help and seek its guidance and listen. And above everything else, as the center around which everything rotates, just sit still and look up. He says, we can gain the truth of Buddhism neither with mind nor without mind. In other words, we've got to go to something beyond what we know. And we've got to go to something greater than ourselves. We've got to go to where the true self is and not just stay stuck with our own opinions, our own emotions, our own karmic dispositions, our own impulses. If the will to train and the way of the Buddhas are not harmonized, neither body nor mind will know peace. What I would put is, if our willingness to train and the way that the eternal is opening before us constantly are not harmonized, neither body nor mind will know peace. It's not just will in the sense of willpower, it's willingness. In other words, you know, what does it mean to harmonize? You know, what does it actually mean to harmonize? You can just take the musical metaphor of harmony. What is it when two voices, or three voices, or four voices are in harmony. Each of them takes the proper position relative to the other to make a beautiful sound. What does it mean, for our will to harmonize with the eternal? We have to take the proper position relative to the eternal. Physically, that's, a lot of time on our knees spiritually, doing our bows, putting the true self above the illusory self, putting meditation and the asking for help, the sitting still, above the old opinions, the old emotions, the old impulses. Seeking our refuge in that which is our true self, rather than in the, what so often is, seems like the quick fix, but which is not a fix at all, but just a complication or a complicating factor. If body and mind are not at peace, if we do not harmonize with the eternal, then we can know only dis-ease, discomfort, dis-ease. Nothing will satisfy. How do we harmonize the way of the Buddhas with training? To do so, the mind must neither grasp nor reject anything. It must be completely free from the fetters of fame and gain. He just pounds away on fame and gain here. And remember the way I spoke of it yesterday. Don't just think of it in its most coarse and obvious form. Although clearly we want to avoid that. But remember that fame and gain are rooted in the longing for love, the longing to be loved and to love, and in the longing for material well-being and security. And as I said yesterday, there's nothing wrong in these things. It's just, if you go beyond a certain point with them, and that's, of course, that's what we do, just if you let karma take it, just roll along, this is where you go way beyond what is wise with them. But if we go beyond a certain point with them and we don't draw back into ourselves and put it all on the altar for the eternal to work on, that longing becomes a fire of pain and a cause of great grieving and despair. Says that the minds of most Buddhist trainees are far from understanding the true way. They do that which others praise, although they know such action to be wrong. They do not follow the true way because it is that which others heap scorn upon. This is indeed a great grief. Such behavior is no right use of the mind of the Buddhas. Now, you said a mouthful there. I really would caution everyone who becomes a monk and everyone who teaches that if you think that you're going to get lots of pats on the back for teaching the truth, you've got a lot to learn about the realities of this business. Many people will resent what you teach and will resent you. And one has to be able to bear that as in as positive and as cheerful a manner as possible. Not everyone will resent you. But you need to keep the truth under your coat with regard to the great majority of people in the world. You won't see people teaching deep religion on television in a white suit with a band behind them. That doesn't mean that people who do that are bad people. Some of them, I've listened to some of them on late night television. That's the only time you can see these people, like at midnight on a Saturday or Sunday night. But some of them, they actually have a lot of good things to say. But that's still not the same as helping people do deep spiritual practice. It's not the same. It's easy to do that which others praise. It's easy to become public with your display of virtue so that others can recognize it, whether it be generosity or kindness. And of course, one can exhibit generosity and kindness and tenderness and sympathy and be appreciated for it, and deservedly so. And one can also come to think that that really has something to do with something real, and it doesn't. So sometimes it's good to exhibit kindness and tenderness and generosity in the way that the world recognizes these things. Sometimes it's good to exhibit more of us, a growl or a, you know, to bring out the Kyosak and give a whack. And the very same people who will highly praise the one will condemn the other, not recognizing it's actually a greater kindness so often. And that actually more trust is being shown in them. I mean, it's easy to, as Reverend Master says, it's easy to recognize Kanzian in a beautiful lady in a white dress. It's not so easy to recognize Kanzian and the demon who's showing you that you shouldn't be doing something that you're doing. And of course, it costs the person who does the latter a lot more than it costs them to do the former. It doesn't cost you much to be kind in a way that, you know, people recognize as kindness. It can cost you plenty to be kind in a way that people don't appreciate what you're doing. And if you're going to be a teacher, you can't afford to care. You just can't afford to care. It doesn't mean you don't have your human feelings, but you cannot afford to care at a fundamental level. You cannot afford to care what other people think and how they react. Now, don't make the mistake, I don't think anyone here would, to think that I'm saying you go around, you know, tromping on other people's toes and just being an inconsiderate boor. Because that's not what I'm saying. One always would prefer to use the gentler methods. And it simply can't always be done. There's also a lot being sold as Buddhism, which is really a kind of admixture of some elements of Buddhism with a bunch of stuff from social sciences and business management theories and all kinds of muck. And a lot of kind of love and light delusion manifesting in Western Buddhism. You know, you have to be able to recognize what is true and what isn't. Not just what appeals to your head, but what your heart will say yes to and what it won't. And steer clear of the stuff that, no matter how much sense it makes to your head, steer clear of the stuff that your heart says no to. He says that many people do not follow the true way because it is that which others heap scorn upon. really important to realize that if we were very public in the way we live our lives in a contemplative monastery, we would bring down a lot of doubt and scorn and resentment upon us, and a lot of fear, which underlies all those things, actually. Our way of life is actually not a comfort to many people in the world at all. It's a threat. It's a threat because it represents, it expresses that there's a lot more to life than most people are settling for. And the way many people live their lives is from the deeper spiritual point of view, a kind of a shadow existence, really. A kind of living death. Settling for second best and failing to achieve even that. He says, the Buddhas and the ancestors selflessly illuminated the universe with their all-penetrating eyes, and it is our duty to copy them. And it is really, actually really important to imitate the example of those who've gone before us who are worthy of being an example. Now, of course, I think of Reverend Master, for me, that great example. But there's many, many stories been passed down and about the lives of the people who one wants to be like. Since Buddhist trainees do almost nothing for themselves, how is it possible that they should do anything for the sake of fame and gain? Only for Buddhism must one train in Buddhism. Out of their deep compassion for all living things, the Buddhas do absolutely nothing, either for themselves or for others, merely doing all for the sake of Buddhism. For so many years that puzzled me. Now I know what it means. For me, I know what it means. You know, for me it means that you follow the Eternal for the sake of following the Eternal and for no other reason. For me, that's what it means to do all for the sake of Buddhism. You follow the Eternal for the sake of following the Eternal. You do the meditation for the sake of doing the meditation. You train in the precepts for the sake of training the precepts. So that you will, you know, gradually work your way to enlightenment. Forget about enlightenment. Just in this moment, be true to your true self. And follow it. Follow its guidance. You know, seek its guidance. Listen. Meditate. And follow. That's an end in itself. It's the only thing I know that's entirely an end in itself. It's not waiting for some future wonderful state, not waiting for the heavens to open. It's not dependent on any external conditions. You can do it in any circumstances whatsoever if you wish to do so. No one else can stop you doing it. No one can do it for you. And this is what he's talking about. It's different from gradually perfecting yourself, becoming a more virtuous person, becoming a more competent person, becoming a more likable person, acquiring a better reputation, becoming a more honorable person. It's different from all of those things. It's fundamentally different. It's becoming more and more someone who has nothing, knows nothing, and clings to nothing. And what is it that you're holding fast to when you have nothing, know nothing, and cling to nothing? You're emptied of self. You're emptied of self, and what's left for you is just to hold fast to the eternal. It's kind of like a person who deliberately puts himself out in the most exposed and risky position and then tries to find their comfort there. And gradually you do find your comfort there. You do find your inner peace there. He talks a bit about compassion, and then he goes on to say, compassion is not the only expression of the great teachings of the Buddhas. They appear in a myriad ways throughout the universe. Since we are all already the children of Buddha, we have no alternative but to follow the path of Buddhism. You, as a Buddhist trainee, must not think of training as done for your own benefit and fame. Nor must you train in Buddhism for the sake of getting results or performing miracles. You must just train in Buddhism for the sake of Buddhism, this being the true way. It's so perfectly and magnificently stated. You know, it deals with the problem of, I've been doing this all the years, and what do I get out of it? You know, I'm still, you know, still struggling day after day. You know, what's in it for me? I'm fed up with just the hard work and the pain of it. What's in it for me? You got to let go of the what's in it for me. Just let go of it. Forget about the what's in it for me. And then just do it for the sake of the doing of it. And then what's in it for you manifests naturally. And it doesn't ever belong to you. Every aspect of enlightenment arises and then passes away. And it's all part of the flow of immaculacy, as is the arising of delusion and the passing of delusion. There's nothing for me in it. There's nothing for me to own in it. And it owns me. And then when you know that you are loved beyond your wildest dreams. That's why the scripture talks about the sage will tell a trainee who is feeling he is low and all inferior that on his head there gleams a jeweled diadem and on his body rich robes hanging at his feet there's a footrest. Well, just take out the sage and put in the eternal. I am not God, and there is nothing in me that is not of God. So what is there for me to attain or to acquire? He then goes on to talk about the necessity of finding a true teacher. I'm not going to try to read all of this, so I'll just kind of amble along and quote the things that strike me as particularly relevant. He says, the truth or falsity of the teacher is in ratio to the truth or falsity of the enlightenment of his disciples. Understand this clearly and become enlightened. Rim Master used to say, you can't tell the quality of a Zen master by just looking at that master and looking at how he behaves, or she. You can't tell anything about him from that. You have to look at the disciples. The disciples are the mirror within which you can see the quality of the teacher. Look at the disciples and say, are these people that I would like to be more like? Then he goes on to give a rather scathing indictment of. I just remind you that when Dogen said these words, Buddhism had been in Japan for something like 600-700 years, right? When Dogen wrote this, he says, "For centuries there have been no good teachers in this country. How do we know? Just look at their words. There is people who try to measure the source of flowing water from a scooped up handful. Throughout the centuries, this country's teachers have written books, taught trainees, and given lectures to both men and gods, but their words were as green, unripe fruit, for they had not reached the ultimate in training. They had not become one with true enlightenment. All that they transmitted were words, reciting names and sounds. Day in and day out, they counted in the treasury of others, contributing nothing whatsoever thereto of themselves. There is no doubt that this is the fault of the teachers of old, for some of them misled others into believing that enlightenment must be sought outside of the mind. Enlightenment must be sought outside of the mind, and some taught that rebirth in other lands was the goal. Herein is to be found the source of both confusion and delusion. Unless one follows the prescription on the medicine bottle, an illness may be made worse by taking medicine. It may even be the same as drinking poison. He goes on to say, talk about teachers who are leading others along the branches of the tree and ceasing to climb up the trunk to the source. They lure others into false paths before they have their own understanding based in certainty. They therefore fix their concentration solely upon their own selfish opinions. It is indeed terrible that teachers have no perception of their own delusion. Under these circumstances, how can disciples understand what is right and what is wrong? He then says, it's an amazing thing, but it's true, and I've said it to many people over the years. If a true teacher is not to be found, it is best not to study Buddhism at all. That's a hard fact, I'm afraid, but it's true. In particular, with regard to meditation practice, I don't know how many people I've run into over the years who are kind of self-taught meditators, or who've been taught by someone who didn't really know their business. And sometimes people have been doing it 10, 12, 14 years or longer, and they're really stuck and really lopsided. Plus, usually burdened with a strong sense that they actually know what they're doing. And that is a terrible combination. And you hardly ever see such people, once they encounter a real teacher and a proper practice, you hardly ever see such people stick to it then. They almost always flee. They would have been better off if they just waited till they found the right person to teach them and started there. You know, this is not just any old religion. But he goes on to say, they who are called good teachers are not necessarily either young or old, but are simple people who can make clear the true teaching and receive the seal of a genuine master. Neither learning nor knowledge are of much importance, for such teachers have a characteristic in their extraordinary influence over others and their own willpower. They neither rely on their own selfish opinions nor do they cling to any obsession, for training and understanding are perfectly harmonized within them. The above are the characteristics of a true teacher. I don't know about that willpower thing. That can be misleading. It's possible for people to discover the secret of will and be totally off the wall. Be totally off the wall. And also to have an extraordinary influence over others. I'd say that their teachings, you know, really touch the heart in the right way. You know, help awaken the longing for the eternal in people and point it in the right direction. That's the influence side. And the willpower thing I'd replace with willingness. Their willingness to the eternal is unconditional, and this allows the eternal to use them. And that's really what's meant by this. I think that if Reverend Master had done this translation after 76 rather than before, I think that would have been more put in the terms I just gave. But this can be, you have to be careful how you understand this. There are some very charismatic people out there teaching what passes for religion, who you should avoid like the plague. Here's the thing. They neither rely on their own selfish opinions, nor do they cling to any obsession. They're relying on the eternal. That's the characteristic of a true teacher. And it really is true that you don't have to have any special knowledge. You don't have to know your doctrine. You know, it doesn't hurt to know your doctrine. It can be helpful. But what really is needed is a really good meditator who's really serious about following the eternal. That's what's needed. That's someone you can grab the oar they hold out and get towed along while you develop your own practice and your own faith. And for those of us who are priests, that's the kind of person we are training to become. Because as a priest, that's what we need to be able to offer people. You know, when you teach, don't just parade your own opinions about things. What good is that? You know, turn within, ask for guidance, and let the eternal, you know, help you point the way for others. You know, our past experience can be a help in this. Our past experience can actually be a considerable hindrance. Because your past experience, if you base your teaching on past experience, you can really convince yourself that you know what you're talking about. And you're really in trouble when you really are convinced of that. It's better to actually not, you know, think you don't really know anything. Because in your very sense of not knowing, you fall back on the eternal for help. Am I making sense? A lot of what he's saying about the situation with Buddhism in Japan, you know, can just be transferred over to our culture. Most of what you hear about Buddhism, most of what I see is just nowhere near the standard of what I've been taught by Reverend Master. I mean, nowhere near it. And the fact that so much of it can make so much sense to your head is makes it all that the more dangerous, actually. You have to seek a true teacher. You have to find your teacher, and you have to hold on to that person and that teaching for dear life. And not be suckered by everything that looks good. You know, our society is just overflowing with what people call information. A tremendous amount of just information about anything other than someone's opinion. And a lot of what passes for Buddhism is just people's opinions about things. And a lot of it's conditioned strongly by psychology, by sociology, by things taken from theories about how businesses and organizations should be run. And, you know, you need to be aware of what is really Buddhism, what is really Buddhist teaching, and what is a crock. And don't buy the crock. Don't buy the hybrid. You need the straight stuff, the non-culturally distorted stuff. Don't buy a cultural distortion. And don't for God's sake, don't, as a priest, don't promote a cultural distortion. Don't try to improve the teachings of the Buddha and the teachings of every master. Instead, have the humility to try to penetrate them fully yourself. Otherwise, you just end up with a massive confusion in your head. And you end up, as a priest, you end up promoting that confusion to others. And you end up in the lamentable state of leading others down the wrong path. It takes so much more to really be a Zen master than just to have done a lot of training. It takes so much more. It takes so much more time. It takes so much more effort. It takes so much more time on your hands and knees. So much more humility. So much more willingness. Dogen's, what he's saying may sound harsh, but by God, I'm grateful that he's willing to just state the truth about things. All that glitters is not gold in religion. And when you finally find the real gold, don't go back to the other things that glitter. Be suckered.